if you fester in silence and you just go along with the status quo, you're not going to have the innovation. You're not going to have the growth and the development. You're not going to be able to have what we all crave and need, which is evolution rather than revolution.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age, from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Garrick Jones. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. And today I'm here with my co-author, Simon Brown.
Hi.
And we're delighted to be joined by Jonathan Besser. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, Garrick. Hi, Simon. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast. Jonathan, you've spent your career helping people learn and grow, and now you've captured decades of insights in 50 ideas that changed the world of work, published by The Economist Group. Can you share a bit about your journey? How did you get here? And whether curiosity played a part along the way, of course. But tell us about these 50 ideas that changed the world of work.
Thanks, Gary. Yeah, 50 ideas changed the world of work. We published it earlier this year, co-authored with my friend and colleague, Jeremy Curdy. It's been a fabulous journey. It's the first book I've written. It's honestly something I never thought I'd be able to say was that I was a published author. It's been all about curiosity and challenge. So curiosity to learn new ideas, curiosity to challenge oneself, to push the boundaries of what one can do. I didn't know about all of the 50 ideas, so I've learned along the way. I've learned new areas. Jeremy and I broke up a lot of the ideas as we went through, and I selected some of the ones that I wasn't too aware of. So I went through. I've worked in leadership development, come across lots of concepts over the 20 years I've been doing it. And this was a great way to learn. So that curiosity in itself, I suppose, all the way along.
I'm definitely going to pull out some of the ideas that have captured my attention from your book. But if you summarize some of your best business thinking out there, from classics to the modern frameworks and so on, what are the things that you feel are most relevant today?
Oh, I think they're all relevant. I mean, yeah, but I would say that maybe from Sun Tzu's Art of War, which is centuries old, right through to some of the more modern areas such as Lean In and Grow. I mean, Carol Dweck's growth mindset's been around since the 60s. I was delighted to see it really entering into business parlance as recently as 5 to 7 years ago, coming through about the intelligence of the way that we can work it and grow within ourselves. So it spans a lot of the old ideas. You've got SWOT, you've got PEST, you've got a lot of different ideas coming through that have been written over decades and in sometimes centuries. They have relevance in what we do and recycling and revisiting for workforces right through from the most junior starter right through to your board level and executive level. It's about how you apply, it's about how you engage.
So, I'm intrigued, Jonathan, how did you decide on these 50? So, of all the ideas across all time, if you went all the way back to Sun Tzu, how did you decide these were the 50?
It's a great question. We, of course, started with a long list of ideas and concepts, came through, discussed, debated. There were a couple of heated virtual arm wrestles about what we were going to cover. Some ideas that we've got at the back of it from the long list coming down to the short. It was really about what was relevant. Where are we in today's workplace and also in society? How do we need to operate? What do we need? How do we push curiosity and engagement? And what can be summed up in 4 to 6 pages of 1,500 to 2,000 words that can be a reference? I mean, the question I often get is, should these 350 odd pages be read from page one all the way through, or dip in and come back? I think the answer is generally just yes. You can use it as a reference book. You can go through, because the ideas build upon each other and they are related into an area where there is crossover and cross-reference and other elements that are going through. So to answer your question, Simon, we had good discussions and interlinks about where it is, what we're seeing, what we knew and what we were willing to really see what was important. Our fabulous publisher with Profile Books, Claire Grace Taylor, helped us with her views as well. What we're seeing wider. Hopefully there'll be another 50 ideas coming through as well, and love people to shape what they think is missing.
I've got a question about, these are all, many of them are old favorites. Many of them are things we've heard, but there were new ones to me, which I really enjoyed very much. Things like the Eisenhower Matrix, for example, I want to explore further. But which do you think are the ones that are like most misunderstood, or the ones which are misapplied?
I think misunderstood, perhaps. I think some of the SWOT and the PEST analysis frameworks go back a long time. they are seen as old-fashioned in a modern-day world, which is very tech-enabled, and you can get an answer through one of your large language models very easily. Think, you know, the ability to, I was working with a client last week where we go through a pest and we do a SWOT to cross-reference and helping come to a strategy. And how are you going to direct what you're doing? Yes, it's gameplay. Yes, it's working through. But walking in your client's shoes, you need to understand what the marketplace is and how you do it. So I think there are a lot of elements and frameworks that are considered old-fashioned and still relevant in what we do. SWOT and PEST are definitely two of those.
It's interesting to me how frameworks, and all of these are frameworks in various respects. We may have used in the past, you know, one framework to achieve this, one for strategy, and maybe added 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and so on. Frameworks are so much a part of how we apply thinking and decision making, and they're very, very useful. To have 50 in one place is very useful, I think. And the thing about frameworks is they're like a language in their own way. You kind of learn a bunch of frameworks and you can go, I need to apply this. I want to make a decision about that. Here is a framework that helps me get there faster. And I think there are huge implications for AI as well, because you get a better answer when you've got a better framework with your prompt engineering, don't you think?
Yeah, it's about pivoting to your curiosity as the starting point, working out what you're going to have and where you're coming from. You know, yeah, I love the podcast because it is about curiosity. And I truly believe the more curious you are, the greater curiosity you have, the greater starting point you have. And that's where you get different interventions, interactions, and opportunities to think and develop and evolve.
Can I ask you about the Eisenhower matrix?
Yes.
What is it and how does it help us prioritize and manage time, do you think?
The Eisenhower matrix really, it helps us distinguish between what is urgent and what's really important. You know, and that distinction can be game-changing in what we do and how we do it. You know, sometimes we get caught up in a whirlwind. Do we answer our stakeholder, either personal or professional? Do we reply to emails? Do we send that email at 9 o'clock or as a leader, you know, 9 p.m. as a leader, should we be leading by example? What do we do? How are we going to be going? What's the most important deadline? Do we knock off the small things that give us a bigger window later on, or do we just try and focus to where we are? So, you know, the matrix is a very simple 2x2, you know, what to do first, what to schedule, what to delegate, and what to eliminate. I'd say the bottom left is hugely important for leaders today. What do we delegate? How do we delegate? And by delegate, I mean you can delegate to a large language model to help you go through that, or you can delegate and grow your people as well. So it's about making that choice. It encourages the ability to think and to develop. And it's hugely valuable about what you can do. It's taking a little time to go through and understand what it is to use it, to then move on.
I never knew that was so called the Eisenhower matrix. I come across that four box grid of urgent and important, but I didn't know that's where it came.
And Simon, maybe that's one of the lessons I learned through this, is that so much that is day-to-day and what we do and how we do it, certainly within learning and leadership development, it comes from some of the elements that discovered over the years.
Yeah, I bet of all the 50, is there one that is like your personal favorite of, you know, this is the one that everyone really needs to pay more attention to and take on board?
So my personal favorite was one because it was a turning point for me, actually, in writing the book. As a first-time author and, you know, with huge amounts of imposter syndrome, I struggled along the way, I really struggled with black swans. I knew about the concept where I was going through, but the struggle was actually about, it was one of the earlier chapters that I challenged myself to go with. And I probably should have started with something I knew better, but it was, does this make sense? Am I doing a good job? Am I, you know, it's the little devil on my shoulder of imposter syndrome of where I was. And so I wrote it and I rewrote it and I ended up being more vulnerable, talking to Jeremy, my co-author, and saying, can you help me with this? And he gave me some great advice, having not even read it. And then I was able to take that step back and revisit. So that was a personal challenge in a way, and has become a favorite chapter because I was able to go down and then talk about the rhinos and develop my thinking. But it was the tipping point to moving where we're going in what it is. So the second answer for that is really probably grow. I think grow is at the heart of how we lead ourselves, how we lead others, how we manage, how we enable curiosity, because curiosity is a launchpad to what we do and how we can do it. And so That's two answers to one question. I apologize. I'm sorry, not sorry in that.
No, I mean, let's maybe dive a little bit into them. So, I mean, the black swan, so COVID seemed to be the recent example, I guess, of a black swan. That tell us more around the model and what you came up with within that process of going through the imposter syndrome.
I mean, black swans was something that I knew about, but it's a relatively simple concept. And trying to get my head around something that was quite simple to make it readable and understandable, but to understand that these are elements that can be foretold, foreseen, and predicted. And then how do you overcome the elements that come back so that hindsight isn't always 2020, coming back to where you are? And that is black swans is a fantastic concept. It's been evolved into the white rhinos. The concept of the white rhinos work. I mean, that was, the white rhinos was something I hadn't heard about. And as I delved into it, was understanding more about foreseeing and foretelling events as we go along.
And then the GROW, I'm assuming the coaching model GROW, but tell us more on GROW.
Yeah. GROW is a relatively, it's an established methodology and model, and there are lots of them for coaching as you go through. You know, it's about asking the right questions. It's about, what do we... what do we need to work with ourselves as coach and coachee? And you can do this with yourself as well. And it's also applicable if you have someone observing for where you are. What's your goal? What do you want to achieve? What's the reality of the situation? Where are you today? What are the opportunities? And then, what do you need to work on to move forward on? And GROW as a cycle is brilliant. However, no 1 hour, 90 minute, 2 hour coaching session is going to encompass everything. So it's about taking the different elements and feeding in. And revisiting and using one of my favorite phrases of two ears, one mouth, using that as an element coming through, using it proportionally to come down and reset, because you have to meet people where they are and asking the questions to where people are. And it's how you do that. The open questions, the what, where, how, why, when, letting people talk, letting people self-discover.
I'm fascinated about the white rhinos. Tell me more about it. Black swans have evolved into white rhinos. Why is it called a white rhino? And what are white rhinos? And I'll tell you why I'm curious is because we've been speaking to a number of futurists in the podcasts before this one, some of whom say we can't predict the future, but we can look at the scenarios that are likely to emerge and plan for that. So we live in the moment, but we're keeping an eye on where things are coming from and where things are going. How is the white rhino useful for us?
Yeah, the white rhino theory, and I don't honestly know where the name came from other than it's the opposite color and an opposite size, perhaps. But it's about the visible threats. It's the pieces on horizon that we see and choose to ignore. And you need to be able to identify them and almost stop yourself from ignoring them. So, whether it be COVID, people have talked about pandemics for years, and they're still talking about it. We could get geopolitical, we're not going to, about vaccine mandates in certain parts of the world going through and about how that will have an effect. We're starting to see things with measles and other elements. Another one was the global financial crisis, about the, people could see where that was coming, and it was ignored for various reasons. We have to normalize the discussion about these elements coming through, about what's happening and why, to be able to see them. The futurists, I get where they're coming from. I work with a lot of futurists. And you can't ignore what's in front of you sometimes, or you have to learn to be able to see it.
Are there any other models that help us in dealing with that? Yeah, looking at that one in particular, there's a lot of these weak signals of where AI is going. And maybe we struggle to envisage that. Are there other models in your 50 that help us in how we manage through the change that we're seeing with AI at the moment?
So the book was written before large language models really hit the marketplace. But of course, AI has been around for a long time. There's lots of the concepts that come into it, from innovation, from thinking, from future thinking for what we're doing. How do we work together? There's the collective viewpoints and mindset that comes together. How do you discuss? How do you evolve?
I'm fascinated by Sun Tzu, of course, and The Art of War. And the idea that it still resonates with modern business leaders. What's your experience of how you see it being applied today and where it's useful?
The fundamentals still apply, even though it's centuries old. Sun Tzu wrote about preparation, positioning, about knowing yourself, about knowing your opponent, whether it be a war opponent or a business opponent, or even when you're looking for trouble. It's about working what you're doing. How do your ideas apply to a new market? How are they relevant? How are you relevant? What value add do you do when you're coming into it? I think modern leaders borrow it perhaps without even realizing. because it's become part of our day-to-day thinking about preparation in what we're doing. You know, how do we use the models, the technology out there to get intelligence, to be able to dive in, to have that competitive intelligence and that advantage, to be able to pull it out of our backpack, to have a difference, to make a difference, to understand better, to be seen as intelligent, to be seen as relevant, to be seen as sharp in where we are. It's about preparation.
So I'm intrigued by, within one of the models, you talk about tipping points, and this is one I've been spending a bit of time on recently, of also sort of crossing the chasm of utility as being, I think, a similar concept to sort of tipping points. So tell us more around, what you learned around tipping points.
Tipping point, Glamour's tipping point was written by my co-author, actually, but of course, it tests my knowledge for what we have going through with it. Tipping point is a game. It's well known. It's in the marketplace of where we are and what we have. It's what do we do from a knowledge point of view? How do we, you know, at what point do you go too far? Or maybe not too far, but at what point do we have enough knowledge to be able to, the inevitable can be true in where we are? You know, the analogy, I suppose, is for a rock rolling downhill. At what point did it gain momentum to go through is my simplest explanation for that.
Tipping points, I mean, are fascinating for me too. I mean, especially in this world of knowledge, and we relate to knowledge and tipping points. We know that a system gets loaded with something and then something happens. It might be unintended consequences. We also know that if you connect lots of hyperlinked information together, something else will emerge, or something will emerge, or something will happen when you get to a point where the system flips in some way. And it might flip in a positive way, or it might flip in a negative way. And then there's also the unintended consequences. If you think of it, as you mentioned, the financial crisis, you had a point where people were finding new and innovative ways to package up financial instruments. And then people found innovative ways to package up those packages and sell them on. And then packages of packages of packages of financial instruments got put into sets and blocks and sold on, to the point where they were very, very far removed from what they were originally, which was some kind of a cheap mortgage. And those instruments then were packaged to a point where they caused a tipping point in the financial system. The financial system crashed. That was 2008's experience. And it doesn't appear that we've learned very much from that, because some of that behavior still goes on. The other thing about economics is that economists are trying to keep tipping points under control and to prepare for them, which is why, you know, when you link the tipping points with the idea of the black swan and what's coming and looking ahead, or even Sun Tzu, preparation, as you say, it's all about casting our net widely so that we have as much information to try and stay relevant and have a perspective. I also think of von Clausewitz, I think, said no plan ever survives its first encounter with reality. And the idea that the thing we have to do is continually take soundings from the real as much as possible, from our customers and from our people we know and from things that are going on and information. And the thing about your book is that it gives us frameworks for doing that. And I feel a little bit like Neo in The Matrix, you know, when he rings up and says, I need to learn how to fly Sikorsky and I need X numbers of ammo now, and then you see it all getting downloaded.
Absolutely. And, you know, that feeds the point I said before. You know, people have said, do you read it from page one through to page 350 or dip in? And it's both. It's the reference. It's the opportunity. But it's also where curiosity can start. I need to know about Sun Tzu. I've heard about SWOT. I've heard about Grow or Lean In. What do I do? Ah, here's a reference and a starting point. It's not all encompassing, and it is a viewpoint. You know, the book covers, it, you know, is very similar in its format of how it works through. You know, we start with the big picture concept about what it is, then we dive into about the idea, about what it is, to get some more detail. You then can move into, you know, the next number, which is, you know, what are the, how do we develop this? What is it in practice? And then some thought starters about how do you go, with a recommendation of where you go. You know, where do you start to understand it, whether it be a TED talk or whether it be actually reading the original book? So to your point, Garrett, absolutely, it's about, you know, a collation of knowledge to feed the curiosity of where we are.
I like also the thing that occurs to me is that some of the frameworks are, as you say, the kind of big picture stuff. They help us get more context, which is really important for curiosity, from our seven C's, as you know. And then there are other frameworks that are really helpful for organizing that information or curating or being critical about that information. And then, as you say, there are other frameworks which are very practical and pragmatic. Can you tell us a little bit about the pragmatic ones, the things that help us move things into reality?
How do you move anything into reality? It's about taking the concept, taking the idea, and moving it along. Where do you make that choice? Where's your individual tipping point to move it along from concept? You know, from being a student and doing a lot of research, moving it into your final thesis, right through to are you reinventing or taking a new concept? Are you taking all the strategic inputs and moving it forward? When is enough information for what you have? And there are frameworks that you have to do. So SWOT, yes, the elements that feed into that, the intention is that they are stepping stones to take you along that pathway, understand where you're going, but where you are. If you want to pin me down to what would be a really good concept for what could do that, possibly the Eisenhower matrix, you could apply that to where you're going. You know, it's the four-box matrix of do first, schedule, delegate, and eliminate. You can apply that to where you are and trying to move something from conceptual to factual and actual in where you are. What would you say, maybe, Garrick, to move that along?
Well, I love that question. It's about design thinking is very relevant there. And the idea that the best way to learn about something is to do something or to make something. Start, as you say, and learn and from failure and go. But start, make a start, do something small, prototype something, and just step up.
I wish I'd had this book 30 years ago, because first I probably came across some of these was SWOT and PEST back, you know, years ago in my degree. But many of these other ones that we've talked about have sort of been picked up either knowingly or sort of in passing over the years. And so I think, this would have been a really useful book 30 years ago to give that, broad brush of the sort of, these are the mental models. These are the sort of ways to start thinking about things. And as you say, it's then a stepping stone off to deeper understanding potentially, but being able to get some of the most critical models or concepts in one chunk, if you like, feels like a very useful book. Yeah.
Flow is a really good example about how a methodology and an approach to working through the progress of what you are. You know, how do you take knowledge to apply? Where is just about enough to be able to get to that disruptive, fail fast mentality? Because you have enough information to make that prototype and to amend from there, because getting your hands on it, getting LinkedIn, taking it, breaking it, applying it is the important part. How do you bring the right people in? How do you know to bring the right people in at the right times to be able to do that? And how do you get feedback on it quickly?
Jonathan Besser is an internationally experienced learning and development expert, diagnostician, designer, coach, mentor, and facilitator. He runs Intrepid Leadership Consulting, which he founded in 2015 to partner with global organizations and individuals on long-term strategic and behavioral development. With deep expertise across a wide range of development, insights, tools, and interventions, Jonathan's collaborated with international organizations, leading business schools, and consultancies worldwide, contributing to diagnostics, program design, and delivery. His first book, 50 Ideas That Change the World of Work, is a culmination of his passion for learning, growth, and bringing practical, timeless business thinking to life. And it's great. I highly recommend it, I have to tell you. It's extremely pragmatic and very useful. I want to ask you, Jonathan, about emotional intelligence and psychological safety, which is something which comes up a lot on this podcast. You know, if you're going to be curious, you need to feel safe, or you need to get to learn how to deal with feeling unsafe. And what are your views on emotional intelligence and psychological safety and how they impact teams, for example?
I think as a starting point, they're the bedrock. They're the foundations that create high-performing teams that allow people teams to work effectively, evolve, to innovate, develop, and frankly, to meet challenge along the way. If you can have psychological safety, if you have high emotional intelligence, you're able to flex in the moment and be held accountable. The concept of a feedback culture is embedded in the idea of emotional intelligence and psychological safety. Without them, you don't have them. And it's elements that it's from the contracting, the setup, the start about what you're doing and how you're going to operate together that gives you the ability to do that. Emotional intelligence is like how you read the room, how you read your colleagues, how you read your clients, how you read the experts coming in to understand what they're doing. How can you manage your own emotions and that of others to get the best out of people with where you are? You have to start with yourself. No one knows you better than yourself, apparently. Some people maybe are less good at that, but there's certainly different elements along that. And psychological safety, you know, Amy Edmondson's work around that, it's a really good starting point for that. And she's encapsulated the viewpoints on that for what it is. You know, it's about creating an environment where people speak up. There is no fear of saying, yes, and, or are you sure? What are you doing here and why? To holding people accountable without consequences, you know, without the fear of, you know, it negatively impacting and being a career limiting move for what you're doing and how you're doing. Ultimately, at its foundations, we're talking about trust. You have to have trust. You know, again, I talked about the tripods and the stool. How do you get that coming in? If you fester in silence and you just go along with the status quo, you're not going to have the innovation. You're not going to have the growth and the development. You're not going to be able to have what we all crave and need, which is evolution rather than revolution.
We're big fans of Amy on the podcast here, having had her on as a previous guest, talking around psychological safety and also her new book around failure and the right kind of wrong. I'm as intrigued as you were looking at the long list of models to include, whether there were any well-known models out there that you decided, actually, I'm not sure that's so relevant in today's world, or we decided we wouldn't include this one in there. So it was maybe what was the one you had the most discussion about and then decided that you wouldn't include it in the 50?
There were plenty that we wanted to include that sort of hit the editing floor, so to speak, as you went along. I pushed and backed off quite hard on Hogan, because I'm a big fan of Hogan as a methodology, as a psychometric, and as a understanding of what we can do and how you can understand people. And that feeds into the elements we've just talked about with emotional intelligence. You can know yourself. Decided not to, because it was a little bit too narrow in its focus of where it was. But I really liked Hogan for what we could do with that.
Yes, Hogan. I remember Hogan's derailers and my 95% propensity for mischief, which sticks with me.
You'd be amazed the number of people that have mischief as a propensity.
Simon, do you still have a 95% propensity for mischief?
I first did it 10 years ago, and I did it again a couple of years ago, and it had changed by about 2%, but it was still a very high propensity for mischief.
And that feeds into to what we've already talked about knowing yourself better than knowing anyone else. And you know, elements like Hogan and others come in, and they help you understand yourself. And as you move into an organization, as you move higher in an organization, you have to know yourself better than anyone else to know how to get the best about other people. I often talk about the manager's curse of hiring yourself as a younger version, and you realize, and then you want to go back to your manager and say, I'm really sorry. And then there's leader's shadow. You have to hire and work outside of your shadow, because that's where you get the best and most innovative ideas, the people who will challenge you, who will work with you, who will evolve and break things fast.
I'm intrigued whether, as you went through the book, whether you also considered where ideas and models can hold us back as well as taking us forward. And as an example, in the last few weeks, we're having a conversation around maybe some of the mental models that we hang on to, and we hang on to them for good reason because they help to sort of simplify and understand the world around us. But whether sometimes we need to discount or put to one side those mental models, because I guess a little bit to the black swan piece, if we hold on to a mental model that this is how things will always be, maybe that actually makes it harder for us to predict where things are going. Did you go into that at all as you were looking at these?
Yes, and less so. I mean, you know, you're talking about blinkers, really, about how do you move outside of the blinkers of what you have. We all, as individuals, we're brought up with orthodoxies and best practice as we go along. And we have to move outside of our own mental models and norms to be able to challenge ourselves. And that comes from surrounding yourself with people who challenge your thinking or open your eyes to new ideas, new models, new methodologies of where you are. So we didn't directly come across it. However, it's one of my founding beliefs. And it comes down to the why. It's the why question. Why are you doing that? Why are we going there? And there are ways to ask why without being super challenging. And different people require different levels of challenge. Let's be honest, we've all been there ourselves and with other people. And it's about being that center point to ask the question about why you're doing something, why you are sticking with this. You know, it was Einstein who said, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. I butchered the quote, but you get the principle of what we're saying. And it's the same thing. Stop using the same models and expecting to get different results. And that's the foundations of it. So the answer is, as I said, yes and. Yes and no. Yes, we did, but no, maybe we didn't challenge it as much as we could have done.
No, I really relate to that. This idea that blinkers, and, you know, I like heuristics and I like models because they help us make sense of the world. But if we get trapped by them, we have to have a healthy disrespect for our models in as much as we respect them. I think they can be blinkers and they can keep us from seeing things around us. And your solution to surround yourself with people who are challenging, hire outside of your shadow, is really one that resonates with me. You know, spend time talking to people who have completely different view on the world, which you might react to initially and go, why do you think like that? But when you spend some time understanding their experience and where you come from, it's enriching and it gives us more. It's kind of why I love musicians and I love artists and people who are outside of business, for example, because they might have a completely different way of solving a problem or even finding a way through a difficult way. Artists specifically who make stuff and do stuff and as a result create stuff, they create new worlds.
Yeah, that feeds to your point, Garrett, that we've talked about previously about making things, you know, unpack, discover, bring others into different viewpoints, work in a parallel stream to be able to know what you're doing and how you're doing it, and invite others in. I will often invite my children, who are now teenagers, but certainly when they were younger, because they have a different viewpoint. They've got a different curiosity. They've got a different mindset about how things work. And you know, asking others in helps it. It helps everything.
My godchildren are all in their sort of late teens and some early teens, but you know, getting into their 20s. It's great for me because I feel I've got a role to play now because I can connect them to people and I can connect them to ideas and I can go with them and we can have great conversations and they ask questions and or they're interested in something in the world and you can open them up and show them those things. And that's challenging for me because they're looking at things. Sometimes I go, well, why don't you know the answer to that? Or haven't you thought about this? Because you realize, no, they haven't. They haven't had the experience. And it makes you look at your own life and go, okay, well, what am I taking for granted? And so on. It's great.
Absolutely. And it also feeds into inputs. There are different inputs from different elements. The world is moving faster and faster. Technology enables so much more to come through in what we're doing. You know, we all of us carry in our pocket a computer that occasionally makes phone calls for us. And, you know, different generations have different ideas and different ways of accessing that information.
You talk about the world's going faster and faster, but have you got a view on like things that have immediate payoffs or things that have like long-term payoffs? You know, what's your view on like how we manage the kind of timelines on things?
It's a great question. It's a good question to ask esoterically as well to get a view on it. I think we are all, you know, our human nature, our biology feeds the need for instant gratification. It's knowing oneself well enough to be able to take a step back and say, why is this happening? Why am I doing this? And what's it feeding into? For leaders, I encourage my coaches, be the last to speak. Contract with your team, but you don't have to. You know, the urge is always to be the smartest person in the room. Take a step back and let others talk. It enables them, it feeds them, and you'll get better ideas that then riff off each other. It comes back to the psychological safety and creating high-performing teams. If you say, right, I'm contracting with you. I will be the last person in the room because I want everyone else's view. I want us to build on it together. It's creating that. But you get growth, you get evolution, you get even an old firm, you get riffing of ideas that build upon each other. It's the idea of a design party, I suppose, to evolve something coming through. That feeds the immediate gratification, but also the longer-term evolution and development. How do we innovate? It's about bringing different ideas, bringing different viewpoints in and challenging.
So maybe a more personal question, if you don't mind. So you referenced earlier around the process of writing the book and the way it makes you feel very vulnerable. You sort of go through the imposter syndrome piece and I think I certainly felt that. I don't know, Garrick and Paul, when you wrote the book previously, maybe you went through it the first time round and were experienced by this time. But that sort of, I'm going to put my ideas out there and people might not like them and they might be wrong. How did you overcome that? Because you clearly did, because the book got published and you sort of worked through it. And then can you tell us your journey there?
The journey for me and my imposter syndrome was one that started a long time ago. And I identified my imposter syndrome sort of when I went through some business coaching myself. We walked around a local park with my coach at the time. And my simple goal was to be able to publish a self-written article on LinkedIn. And it's that whole, am I good enough? Do I have a point of view? Where am I coming from? The questioning, I talk about it as the sort of little devil on my shoulder, which I still flick off at times. And it's identifying that element coming through. With regard to the book, there was a big upfront piece about, can I do this? Do I have a right to do this? Who am I to be able to be bringing this along? And I full credit to Jeremy, my co-author, for helping me through that journey and say, yeah, JB, you can do that. Deal with it. You can approach it. And it has truly helped me to be able to hold this manifestation in a copy and to be able to say, yeah, I can do it. I had to deal with the, people will disagree. You're putting yourself out there, you're putting a bit of yourself out there. You've got everything from some of the big book publishers who can do online reviews, anonymous or otherwise, and people will do it. Have an opinion. It's been a great journey. It's like, I have an opinion. I am an opinionated person. I'm also someone who listens and invites feedback. And I said, I've got two teenage kids. I live in a feedback culture the whole time, frankly. But if you don't put yourself out there, how are you going to grow? How are you going to evolve and develop if you don't take it on? Now, you don't have to agree with the feedback the whole time, whether it be personal development, professional feedback. It's about how you take it on and how it affects you. And people have opinions. I have opinions. Other people have opinions. It's how you evolve and work through that. So I dealt with it by leaning into it in a way and trying to recognize what were the elements that were challenging to me and being brave. We created a psychologically safe environment. We created an environment where we supported each other with fabulous support from, Claire Grace Taylor at Profile Books as well to help us through. And she gave us some very tough love as we went along. And we tried to learn, we tried to evolve, and hopefully the product that's come out is better as a result of that.
I have a question about imposter syndrome. It's funny to me because one of the music bands that I'm obsessed with at the moment are some Argentinians called Catriel and Paco Amoroso. These two young guys in their 30s, 20s, come out of the trap hop, hip hop scene in Latin America, sing in Spanish. And, very localized Argentinian. They were famous there, but, that was where things were going on. They did an NPR Tiny Desk. They were invited to do that where you can't use any electronics. It's all got to be real instruments. And they put a band around them and they reproduced some of their songs. And it just went viral, 35 million, 100 million people watching this thing. And now they're on a world tour and they just played Glastonbury and they've done Coachella and they played with the London Philharmonic and the LA Philharmonic with Dudewell. I mean, and now they're all over the world and they're going to Japan next week, et cetera, et cetera. Just incredible. So everything comes out, and the very next song that they put into the market is called Imposter Syndrome, because they suddenly blew up. Everybody's watching them on their phones, and they say that we couldn't sleep for 2 weeks in their song, and they write about it. And the thing that's refreshing about this generation is they're quite cynical about social media. They're quite cynical about the world they live in and all the technology, but they also talk about it, and they laugh about it, and it's fun. And you deal with imposter syndrome by just being open and honest about it. And that's one of the things I'm hearing from you.
I think it's wonderful. The evolution is very much generational.
My question is, what do you think is the potential to become the next big shift in how we work? Where do you think it's going?
It's a great question. I think as we come, the generations hitting the workforce lived through COVID and lockdowns and being away, and they are craving that. They're like a sponge. They're curious. They have knowledge for knowledge, for insight. But most importantly, interaction. How do we work together? What can you tell me? How can I do? And the expectation that they have a viewpoint that is also heard and taken in. So I think it's the movement forward of how do we work with that? How do we not use old-fashioned orthodoxies about, I'm the boss, you're coming in, you will learn from me. how do we learn from the expertise that everyone brings in with what they're doing? And how do we harness that energy and that wish and that will to do and to be heard? You're seeing smart people coming in who are hugely knowledgeable, hugely capable. They have their idiosyncrasies the same way we did when we hit the marketplace, and we still do. How do we stop being the sage on the stage and harness that? The person, the group, the network that can do that. And we're seeing little smidgens out there. I see that with some of my work with big clients, recognizing that within work environment. Large language models, AI, we're seeing that coming in and using it as an enablement, as a springboard. That's where the next shift is coming.
And are there any uniquely human skills you think that will help us as that shift takes place? So, you know, what are the skills that people in school or leaving school at the moment need to be thinking about as the things that will carry them forward in their careers?
It's the name of the podcast. It's about being curious. I'm glad to be here with that, and I'm glad for the question. It's about being curious, but it's being curious about yourself. It's about being curious about other people. I've been through a long learning phase with my eldest daughter, who, you know, there's some neurodiversity, and she uses her phone in a very different way and uses it to come down. And the curiosity that comes in triggers my orthodoxies about everything that I've read and what you can do. And it's about harnessing that to get the best out of the environment. The most human basic knowledge, you know, basic facet is curiosity, is about asking why, and why do you think that? And two ears, one mouth, waiting to hear the answer. And then that 3-second rule, take a breath.
It's funny, I was at my daughter's middle school graduation a couple of weeks ago, and the teachers were talking about some of the pupils that had won prizes, and the number of times that curiosity came up in those conversations. It was a bit of a running joke that my wife would nudge me each time it got mentioned, but it was a theme around, you know, the people that they selected as the sort of award-winning pupils from across the year, and curiosity seemed to be the common trait across many of them.
Don't get me wrong, it's maddening for leaders who are used to being listened to. We have to retrain ourselves to harness that. Because frankly, we should all be looking to hire and bring on individuals who want to take our jobs, because we can't move on either professionally or as a society until we have people ready to evolve and take forward what we do and how we do it. We should be harnessing and nurturing those, in my humble opinion.
We're having to come to the end of this conversation, but I have to ask you, what are you personally most curious about right now, Jonathan?
I'm curious about where the bright young minds I'm working with are going forward. What I'm asking people about what they think and how they use it. And it's what I do with that. I'm curious about how I can evolve my thinking. You know, I just turned 50 this year. You know, I've got more years behind me than ahead of me, potentially. And I'm seeing people much smarter than I am, much more knowledgeable. So my curiosity is, how do I stay relevant and how do I stay connected to evolve forward? Where's my point, my place in technology, youth, and I'm somewhere sandwiched in the middle?
Perhaps you're the 51st idea.
Maybe. Maybe I need to do a self-biopic.
We can talk to Jonathan Besser. He's covered a huge range of topics because he's written a book, 50 Ideas That Have Changed the World of Work. And he's talked to us things like challenging and pushing boundaries, learning, Sun Tzu, The Art of War, growth mindset, SWOTs and pests, those old favorites. And your personal favorite around black swans, great conversation around white rhinos and their relationship, and then the GROW coaching models. You talk about 2 ears and one mouth, and I think that's going to stay with me. We've got 2 ears and one mouth, so keep it in proportion. Talk about normalizing and the things that are in front of us and not ignoring the stuff that we don't pay attention to, because by paying attention to these things, we can find things that may be standing in the way or things that can really help us move forward. The way I think about everything we've been talking about is you've kind of had this deep dive and you've got the synthesis of things we take for granted around us, which is super useful. You ask the question, how are we relevant and how do we intelligence and use that for our advantage. And we talked about tipping points and crossing the chasm of utility. And so where does that take us? Where does curiosity start? And what is the starting point? 50 ideas are just great starting points, provide us with big pictures and then moving down into the detail. We talked about design thinking and how to do things and move things into the real flow, psychological safety and being curious and the need for trust, and how these things allow us to be curious and creative. Tripods and stools, and of course, evolution and revolution. Then we're looking for evolution rather than revolution. Questions about what you left out, and Simon's 95% propensity for mischief, which I'm going to hold on to. Knowing yourself again, and the importance of the leader's shadow, and how important to bring in people from outside of our shadow, because that's where we learn. How can these models that we hold and these heuristics hold us back if we're not careful? And how do we get rid of the blinkers? Ask ourselves why. And another point you made a lot about asking ourselves why, and why are we doing things, and what's getting us to the basics of what it's all about, and how not to just focus on instant gratification. And then a conversation about what the next big stuff is and what's going, and the post-COVID generation, which is, you talk about them being a sponge and open to learning and figuring out where to go forward, which gives us hope. And how do we plug into the energy of the next generation, which is very interesting. I mean, just on the side, I got a bunch of young friends who had a party, and they asked everyone to leave their phones at the door. I've got other young friends who don't, you're not using social media the way you would expect them to. They're voting with their feet, perhaps. Talked about how AI is an enabler for the future. And you talked about how all of these are skills for carrying ourselves forward. Most important, thankfully, for us is curiosity, which we completely agree with. Jonathan, if there's one thing to leave our listeners with, what would it be?
Thanks, Gary. And great summation of a great conversation. I think the one thing to leave you with is check your own assumptions. Ask yourself why you're doing something. Why are you doing a certain thing? Why are you thinking a certain way yourself in that moment? Apply that curious lens to yourself. Don't be afraid to ask why. And have a moment to understand why of the why.
Thanks so much for joining us, Jonathan.
Thanks very much for having me. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, I encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what have you learned from it. We always appreciate hearing your thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today, hashtag The Curious Advantage. The Curious Advantage book is available on all major bookstores and Amazon worldwide. Order your physical, digital, audiobook copy now to further explore 7C's model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Jessica Wickham.